Good morning. This is OPB News. I'm Christian Foden-Wenzel. It's a primary for all the marbles in the race for Oregon Attorney General. There are no Republicans running, so whoever wins the May Democratic primary will probably cruise to victory in November. Salem correspondent Chris Lehman had a look at the two Democrats who could enforce laws that affect everything from your pocketbook to your personal safety.
Candidate John Kroger is a federal prosecutor turned law professor. His opponent, Greg McPherson, is an attorney and state representative. In the Oregon House, he chairs the Judiciary Committee. But the race might not hinge on resumes. Instead, it could come down to a difference in philosophy. Is the attorney general the state's top prosecutor or the state's top consumer advocate?
I think it's clearly the latter.
That's Greg McPherson. He says the attorney general shouldn't focus on criminals.
We have 36 district attorneys who prosecute crime. They do a great job of it in the 36 counties of the state. What our attorney general is the chief lawyer and advocate for Oregonians.
McPherson says his legislative experience demonstrates the kind of advocacy he'd engage in as attorney general.
I've passed laws cracking down on home meth labs, internet sex predators, and identity theft, protecting people from crime and consumer fraud. I helped write and pass ballot measure 49, protecting our open space and farmlands from uncontrolled development.
McPherson has the support of outgoing Attorney General Hardy Myers, and many have drawn comparisons between the two. John Kroger says he'll bring a different approach to the job.
Hardy has always been somewhat of a behind-the-scenes legal figure, someone who provides legal counsel to other state actors. I plan to use the bully pulpit of the office to try to raise the profile of the office and to try to have an impact on public affairs throughout the state.
Kroger says he'll go after drug dealers by beefing up the Attorney General's organized crime unit. And he says he'll crack the whip on renegade polluters.
Right now, there's not a single full-time environmental crimes prosecutor in the state of Oregon. And as long as that's the case, we're never going to have an effective enforcement program. So one thing I will do is put full-time environmental crimes prosecutors on the staff of the Department of Justice to make sure that when people damage the environment and public health, we can go after them.
Kroger's vision for the Attorney General's office would be a departure from recent Oregon tradition, says political analyst Jim Moore. Still, Moore says he's surprised at how low-key the race has been so far.
We're not seeing huge numbers of ads. We're not seeing huge outreach to the community. We're not seeing an active campaign at this point. Basically, Kroger and McPherson go and talk to groups, but that's it.
Voters interested in the race will have to start paying attention soon. No Republicans are running. That means registered Democrats voting in the May primary will effectively select the next Oregon Attorney General. I'm Chris Lehman reporting.
This week, an independent scientific panel on spotted owl protections should have its report ready for the public. If Mother Nature complies, it could coincide with the hatching of another baby owl expected soon at Ben's High Desert Museum. The last baby owl hatched last week to proud parents by the names of Polka and Dot. Remember, these are spotted owls. In fact, they're the only captive spotted owls to have ever successfully hatched offspring. Central Oregon correspondent Ethan Lindsay reports.
In the Birds of Prey exhibit at the High Desert Museum, kids run around checking out falcons and hawks and bald eagles. They can even stop at a listening station to hear what sorts of hoots and howls the birds make. Tucked in a dark corner, Dot the spotted owl sits in her nest watching the onlookers warily. Usually, she doesn't get all that much interest. But these days, museum staff and the public are paying a lot of attention. There's even a TV camera and monitor set up to get a good look at her nest. That's because there are baby owls there for people to ogle.
They'll be able to look down into the nest and see that chick moving around. And, of course, everybody loves baby anything.
Nolan Harvey is the museum's wildlife curator. To feed the owls during these tense times, Harvey has to wear a protective outfit to avoid getting hurt by Polka, the male owl.
You know, they are a bird of prey, so they have very sharp talons, and it's a hazard for us, and it could also stress and injure the bird. And being attacked by the male is very protective.
He says these two are the only spotted owls to have ever successfully reproduced in captivity. Between 2003 and 2005, they produced six chicks. But they're old birds. So when Dot didn't lay any eggs in 2006 and 2007, Harvey says they thought maybe it wasn't going to happen again. But he says the owl's friskiness has two positive outcomes. One, people will get a chance to check out the cute baby owls, who will be stretching their wings and learning to fly.
They'll get active, and they'll be looking for food and begging for food and, you know, like any baby, driving mom crazy while they're looking for something to eat.
Also, another captive hatching means that the spotted owl population has hope despite its threatened status. Remember, the spotted owl lives in old-growth forests. And because the owl is now threatened under the Endangered Species Act, Oregon's timber industry got hamstrung by logging restrictions to protect the owls.
You know, spotted owls are an old-growth forest owl. They live in a very unique niche, and they're not that adaptable. So to be in that niche and to survive, and with old-growth forests declining and things of the sort, you have an animal that whose niche is becoming smaller and smaller, which affects the population.
Harvey says that's why new owl chicks could be so critical. Eric Forsman is a wildlife biologist with the U.S. Forest Service. He's actually seen some of Polka and Dot's earlier offspring surviving and possibly even reproducing in the wild. But he says the chicks born in Bend aren't going to change the world.
Really, no one thinks that it's going to help very much, really. I mean, the main concern with spotted owls is habitat and also competition with the barred owl, which is, you know, a new species that's invaded this region. You know, those are the main concerns. Captive breeding probably is not going to do us a lot of good.
Forsman says scientists and the public can certainly learn from the new generation at the High Desert Museum. But he says in order to rebuild the spotted owl population significantly, researchers need instead to focus on reducing the number of rival barred owls in Oregon and preserving old forest habitat. Ethan Lindsay, OPB News, Bend.
William Wellborn is a flight medic with the Oregon National Guard. He's one of about 3,000 Oregonians who will be traveling to Iraq next year. The 36-year-old is from Silverton and usually spends his time as a registered nurse at the VA hospital on Portland's Pill Hill. He visited OPB with his kids to figure out the best way to document his unit's deployment, and while here I asked him where exactly he's going and what he's going to be doing.
We're going downrange next year to Iraq to do what we do best, which is medevac support, that is the evacuation of sick and wounded soldiers with Black Hawk helicopters. And we do that all over the world. We do it here in Oregon. We do mountain rescues. We go out for the flood relief, most recently, like out in Vernonia. and then we also get called up for this, you know, worldwide mission, you know, support the war on terror.
So you're working with the military, with the medical side. You're going to be dealing with PTSD and the mild traumatic brain injuries or traumatic brain injuries. What kind of things are you seeing?
Well, the Army is coming around and doing a good job of trying to educate everybody, and I'm actually the unit, my unit's educator for both the mild traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress. And what we're trying to do is take some of the stigma out of it on the military side and, you know, with that education, make sure we're, you know, documenting people that get exposed to these things, because when you look at the statistics, it's really, you know, affecting a lot of soldiers on these deployments. You know, some of the statistics are coming up to like 30% on the PTSD. And the mild traumatic brain injury is different from the traumatic brain injury in that it could just be a concussion. It could be caused from even a vehicle accident. It can be caused from the blast waves, you know, from a blow to the head. You know, there's a lot of different things, but what they're finding is it is affecting, you know, how people are processing and you know, how they're able to do their job. So as, you know, the medics today, you know, in my civilian job, I'm a registered nurse, but as a flight medic over there, we're going to be working really hard to make sure, you know, we identify people that have been exposed to these things and document it clearly, because, you know, later on, you know, I'm very cognizant of it as a registered nurse of the Department of Veterans Affairs, because I see guys that were from Vietnam and even World War II that, you know, their medical records never got documented and they're having difficulty accessing care today.
Okay, I understand you have a family and you're going to be going and leaving them here. You've been once over to Afghanistan already. What kind of pressures do these kind of deployments put on you and the family?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting because it's always evolving and changing as the kids are getting older now. It's certainly a lot different. They're, you know, I'm real proud of my kids. They're very bright, intelligent young people. So it's different this time because they have more of a understanding of what's going on. And it's not just, you know, dad's gone for a year. They're older now where they watch the news and they're pretty in tune. You know, they're smart kids. So you're not gonna fool them.
So joining us in the studio is Matthew and Emily. Matthew is 12 and Emily is 15. Dad is going probably in beginning of January next year. How are you guys going to deal with it, and how have you dealt with it in the past?
I just try to keep myself busy with all my activities. I do a lot of horseback riding, and next year I'm joining OSIT. So.
And how about you?
Well, the hardest part about having a parent that goes over to Afghanistan or Iraq or to the war is that sometimes after about a month or two, you kind of forget what they look like, and so it's kind of hard because it's just, you know, you've been with them for your whole life and all of a sudden they're gone and you can't even remember what they look like.
How do you keep in touch?
Well, like when my dad went over for the first time, he would send letters and like pictures that he cut out of a magazine and make, you know, funny letters that he would send to us. And sometimes, on rare occasions, he'd be able to get to a phone and call us.
And does it affect your schoolwork at all, or is it just you buckle under, get it done, while he's buckling under, getting jobs done overseas?
A hard part is that, like, sometimes when you're doing your classwork, you're just, like, you're sitting there and then you're thinking, like, well, what if something bad is happening to them right now? Then you don't know, and then, like, it might be a couple months before they actually relay something back to you. And so just, like, the whole time, it's kind of hard to focus on stuff because there's that constant fear that something might happen to your parents.
Anything you wanted to add, just listening to your kids?
Well, they're just really smart kids, so I'm just always really proud of them.
William Wellborn is a flight medic with the Oregon National Guard. He's one of about 3,000 Oregonians who will be traveling to Iraq next year. For years, heated debate has focused on taking out the four lower Snake River dams and other obstructions to salmon habitat in the Pacific Northwest. But now, Washington officials are looking seriously at building more dams. The state is studying a handful of sites, mainly in eastern Washington, for more water storage. Richland correspondent Anna King explains.
The Northwest's dramatic population growth, failing salmon runs, and concerns over global warming have people like Jerry O'Keefe at the Washington Department of Ecology rethinking the upside of dams.
It's a surprising world to find ourselves in after all this time looking at these facilities and consequences of having developed them on the environment, to find that there may well be environmental benefits that accrue from further construction of facilities.
According to O'Keefe, the benefit would be making more water available in the dry summer months when fish, people, and agriculture need it most. And instead of erecting massive concrete monoliths in the main stem of a river, the new proposals call for building on tributaries or pumping river water into dry canyon reservoirs during the winter. Charles Hudson is with the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. He says any new dam would destroy valuable salmon habitat and create more stagnant water that kills fish.
We believe that there's a fair bit of opportunism going on under the rubric of climate change, that we must build new dams because we will lose control of our water management as snowpack and snowfall and rainfall change on us. We don't buy it.
Instead, Hudson says the state should be looking at improving natural watersheds by rehabilitating wetlands and forested areas. But even if a new dam is approved, it would take 15 to 20 years to study and fund it. I'm Anna King in Richland.